This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about how Professor Jules Lobel made out when he attempted to protect the rights of protesters at the G20 demonstrations in Pittsburgh last week.
As far as the authorities in Pittsburgh were concerned, the First Amendment didn't apply to Pittsburgh.
We'll hear about the efforts of domestic workers to organize to demand a Bill of Rights.
Hear how a growing national movement of domestic workers is changing the face of labor laws in the United States. Stay with us.
We want to remember a special person who died last week, Rick Wagner, a comrade and a colleague of ours, an attorney who worked with the Center for Constitutional Rights later and for quite a long time, worked with Brooklyn Legal Services Corporation A, doing some extraordinary work.
He was probably one of the best tenant lawyers in New York, really scared the heck out of landlords, worked in the poorest census tract in the United States, out in Brooklyn. And we will really miss Rick. I mean, he was a real character, not afraid of anything, fearless in a courtroom, and just out there. And it was a sad death because it was much too early. Rick was, I think, 65 or so.
Yeah.
And it was a heart attack, it appears, and taken from us much too early. But he was an amazing, remarkable.
Truly a lawyer you'll like.
We're joined by Marty Needleman, co-director of Brooklyn Legal Services A, who's been there for 35, 40 years, knows Rick, not only out in Brooklyn, but in the country, particularly recently on mortgage foreclosures.
Marty Needleman, co-director of Brooklyn Legal Services Corporation A, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, guys.
Marty, it's not a happy occasion for you to be on, but we have a segment on this program called Lawyers You'll Like. Rick Wagner was up there as a lawyer you'll like, and your comrade and colleague for many years out at Brooklyn A. We wanted to speak with you and reminisce a bit about our friend Rick Wagner. Tell us some stories about Rick. What was it like to work with him?
Well, Rick was not necessarily a lawyer you liked, but he was a killer. I always said that he's such a great lawyer, but you wouldn't necessarily want to invite him to lunch with your children because you could kill them by accident. but he was just a fiery, committed, brilliant, creative guy, and just devoted his whole professional career to struggles for, universal justice, the large one, but also neighborhood-based justice, and was involved in a whole lot of different lawsuits and struggles on behalf of community groups and tenants associations and very humble people.
He pioneered some of the major tenants litigation out at Brooklyn A, as I recall. I mean, particularly against landlords using the RICO law.
Absolutely. There was Elvin McBeal, and there was another development, whose name escapes, Medgar Evers. Two major housing developments, which Rick, through litigation and organizing, also empowered the tenants and enabled them to really amazingly creatively take the buildings away from major developer landlords and get control of them, and in one case got ownership of them.
The New York Times characterized the moment when the landlord turned the deed over to Rick's group as the landlord coming to God moment. that's when they sued him under the RICO Act for a racketeering.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Rick was not beloved by people who are oppressed, low-income people. I mean, these mortgage scams and rescue scams and just general predatory lending, often backed up by huge, mega economic interests. I remember in one case, it was like a billionaire from California, but really a billionaire. And it was a mega operation that was essentially subsidizing predatory lending at all over the country and making a lot of money. And Rick broke that up.
I know that, the Times had pieces on how funny he could be and how tough he could be. And it was great. I guess it opened with saying how he would refer to all of these guys, the landlords, as ganavs, of course, the Yiddish word for essentially thief, more or less. In that vein, he was apparently a very, very tough lawyer, but also had an incredibly sharp sense of humor.
Yeah, he told one kind of dull-witted prosecutor that he couldn't find his own ass with a GPS. I remember him telling me, because he had a real egalitarian spirit about him, and I think that's one of the things that allowed him to relate so well with the clients out in Brooklyn. And he said, people come up to me and they say, Mr. Wagner. And I said, Mr. Wagner? That's my father, Mr. Wagner. I'm Rick.
Now, he was head of your housing litigation unit, Marty?
Well, he was our director of litigation overall, and really was the big case litigation for a lot of different cases, including attempts to build a jail in Brownsville instead of housing. But in the last 5 years, I guess, he focused completely on this foreclosure prevention and created a unit from scratch with five lawyers and a paralegal that's really been one of the leaders in the country. I didn't realize the extent to which his contacts had developed, and we got condolence messages, very, very touching condolence messages from consumer lawyers and anti-foreclosure lawyers from all over the country. And actually, they're going to nominate him to be the honoree this year's National Association of Consumer Advocates.
What's amazing about it, of course, is most of the country become conscious of foreclosures and what's really been going on. And, of course, as you said, Rick set up this unit
10 years ago.
Wow.
He really started the work and got involved in some amazing cases where not only did he stop a foreclosure, and in some cases, he got them to, in many cases, the deeds have been transferred over or the foreclosure's already happened. He got it undone, and he got the building back. And these are all people who are very humble, first-time homeowners whose every penny was invested in that and are the focus of predators. And he really just significantly turned it around, and huge penalties associated with some of these cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars mortgagees had to pay. It set a tone and began to send a lesson to some of the others that I think has had an intimidating impact, at least slowing down some of this stuff, at least in the area that he was working in.
Marty, tell us about the community that Brooklyn Legal Services Corporation serves out in Brooklyn.
Well, we have three offices, one in Williamsburg, which Rick worked in originally, and we have a Bushwick office, but our East Brooklyn office is a very large office, and that's where Rick has been for the majority of his career. We're very diverse communities because our East Brooklyn office serves East New York and Brownsville and Cypress Hills and Canarsie and Flatlands and Ocean Hill.
Is it true that your zip code is one of the poorest or maybe the poorest urban zip code in the United States? Is that possible?
No. That area, absolutely.
Really? The poorest urban zip code?
11212 zip codes. That is the heart and soul of a concentrated low-income population. Being regenerated by an amazing network of community organizations which Rick's colleagues and Rick have worked on very closely in developing and supporting their efforts to sustain an infrastructure that really has allowed people to, despite their low incomes, to create a village over there, and that people are living together and growing.
The role that legal services played in that out in Brooklyn is really extraordinary, because the federal government, starting with Ronald Reagan, did everything it can to pull the teeth out of legal services. And the way you guys have organized and gotten around that is just truly commendable.
Now, Marty, if people want to learn more about Rick, about Brooklyn Legal Aid, is there a website we can go to?
Yes, absolutely. It's B as in Brooklyn, KABKA.org.
Great. Well, we'll post that on our website, lawanddisorder.org, so people can make a connection to Brooklyn A, and I'm sure you'll have stuff up about Rick so that people can read about that. Marty Needleman, co-director of Brooklyn Legal Services, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you, Marty.
We only get together at these sad occasions.
Well, it hasn't been in the news that much lately. The issue of whether the torture team will be prosecuted is still rumbling around. The most recent issue came up when seven former heads of the CIA wrote a letter to Eric Holder protesting the fact that Holder had appointed a prosecutor to investigate part of the torture team. Not really the team, but the lower level people. As we pointed out on this show, what Holder has done is only told that prosecutor that he has the authority to look at those who were engaged in what I call torture plus. In other words, you could torture up to the line of what the so-called Justice Department authorized, but if you tortured beyond that, Holder said, we want to look at those cases, a few of those cases. As we have pointed out, that's just an excuse for doing nothing or worse than nothing, really allowing torture to have gone up to a certain line, but simply not beyond it. So you can waterboard someone X times, but not Y times. So you could break one arm and not the other. So you could throw them against the wall 10 times, but not 20. So we don't find that acceptable. The fact that seven CIA former heads objected to that is just ridiculous, but it shows how this country has really sunk into the mire of torture. In regard to that, the Center for Constitutional Rights is making an effort and is continuing to make an effort to push for prosecutions of the torture team. I want to encourage people to go to the center's website, click on a button for torture team, and you can get yourself 20 trading cards titled Torture Team with different pictures and facts about each of the torture team's members, the 20 that we have chosen. For example, there's a card with Jay Bybee from the Office of Legal Counsel, who's now a federal judge, who was involved in writing some of the torture memos. It has a picture of him in front of some law books, and on the back, it talks about his career highlights. What it says is, wrote the August 2002 memo that redefined torture to exclude waterboarding, walling, throwing people against the wall, in order to provide legal cover to U.S. torturers. And then it has Did You Know on the back. When not signing torture memos, Bybee is a cub master for the Boy Scouts. And it says, currently, what is he doing? Interpreting the Constitution, exclamation point, as a federal judge. And then it has a piece on the back along with his signature that says, in his own words, quote, the mere inflicting of pain and suffering on another is not torture, end quote. So that's an example of a torture team trading card. They're free at the center's website. That's ccrjustice.org. Get your torture team trading cards now and then do something with it. We don't think this campaign, this effort to get the torture team indicted is over. It's taken years in some cases. It may take years here. But we hope one day that these people will be standing trial. Last week, we interviewed Jules Lobel, a lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights, on his recent representation of many, many groups in Pittsburgh attempting to demonstrate and show their opposition to the politics of the G20 group. As far as Jules is concerned, Pittsburgh might as well have a sign on its entrance saying, all those who believe in the First Amendment, abandoned hope. Pittsburgh was essentially closed down until Jules went to court to try and guarantee some protest rights for a few of the people who are trying to show their opposition to the G20. It's an incredible story of how one city in this country, really replicating others, is trying to end the First Amendment in this country. We're joined by Jules Lobel, Vice President of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who will discuss with us the closing down of Pittsburgh to First Amendment rights and protest. Jules Lobel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for inviting me.
Now, Jules, I know for the last week, or in fact 2 weeks, you've been working on a series of lawsuits with the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU in Pittsburgh with regard to trying to guarantee the right to protest of various groups who are involved with G20. The first question I have for you is, what is G20?
G20 stands for the Group of 20. It's the major industrialized nations in the world, and they get together to plan, you know, economic, environmental policies. And there's a lot of groups that object to the policies that they've planned over the years because they cause environmental devastation, economic catastrophe, particularly in poorer countries.
I guess it's a huge thing in Pittsburgh because, well, not just Pittsburgh smaller in the last few years, but that you have heads of state from the G20, I guess.
20 countries.
Heads of state actually come?
Yeah, the heads of state come. It's a big deal. The heads of state and big delegations. Apparently the Japanese delegation is 250 people.
So is Pittsburgh already showing some signs of that? We're talking to you a couple of days before the G20 or a day before?
Well, it's the day before, and there's a much increased police presence. Roads are starting to close down. They're going to close down all of downtown Pittsburgh to traffic, basically, starting Thursday morning. Big fences put up around the convention center, and there's a fence put up in the park right next to the university because one of the meetings is going to occur fairly close to the university.
So why don't you give us a little background of what your involvement has been legally, that some of the groups have wanted to protest or make different kinds of points in front of the heads of state or in front of G20. And tell us about your first case that you got involved in. What happened in Pittsburgh?
Well, first of all, generally, you have to understand that there is a repressive environment once this G20 was announced. The big concern was on security. And they're bringing in 4,000 to 5,000 police from out of Pittsburgh. It was classified a national security event, which means that the Secret Service really controls what's going to happen. Once you decide to have the government decides to have a meeting like this in Pittsburgh, the whole city takes on a different environment, both in terms of police repression and in terms of the restrictions, even of ordinary citizens. So we had a number of groups that wanted to plan protests, and they started planning this in the middle of July, early August. They sent in applications for permits, and what happened was the city either did not respond, because one of the tactics that we know that the cities have used in this type of situation is basically to delay and stall granting peaceful permits. These were all groups that wanted to conduct peaceful demonstrations where they wanted to get the cooperation of the city and the federal authorities in planning a demonstration that would be allowed and permitted and would happen peacefully.
So why'd you have to go to court, Jules?
We had to go to court because for a long time they would not give any of these groups permits.
None at all?
In some of the cases, for a long time they gave no one a permit. In some of the cases, they just flatly denied a permit, like the Code Pink request to use Point State Park and the environmental group's request to use, it's called the Three Rivers Climate Convergence, their request to use Point State Park. In those cases, they just flatly denied a permit.
Jules, I have a question. I read something in the Times about a loss that you took in the last couple of days.
Yeah, yeah. So let me just tell you the last piece of it. We asked for overnight camping at not in the downtown park, but in a major park in another part of the city, far away from the convention center. Again, no security concerns. But the city said we don't allow overnight camping, and we lost on that. So the environmental group decided to set up a morning-to-evening sustainability camp. But to do that, they needed food, and they needed a whole infrastructure. So they got several buses of people who, young kids, who are very idealistic and do this apparently all over the country. They come in and they feed demonstrators. They went to New Orleans after Katrina, and they grow organic food. They run the bus on organic fuel. It's a whole environmentally sound and safe operation. Anyway, these young kids came to town for their main purpose of providing food, which was critical for this environmental group's sustainability camp, this protest that they were going to engage in for a whole week. And here's what happened over the last weekend, which forced us back into court. It's a group of young kids. The police was suspicious. The first thing they did was they gave them a ticket. They were parked outside of the house that they were staying in one section of the city. They gave them a ticket, and they impounded their bus. They have retrofitted bus, and the ticket was for parking more than 12 inches away from the curb.
I don't believe it. I almost can't believe it hearing it.
The police in New York City or in Pittsburgh went through the city and measured out where people's wheels were and impounded every car.
The
whole city would be overflowing with impounded cars. So anyway, they did that. The people said, okay, they went and we tried to get the bus back. They finally had to pay $220. They got the bus back. They got a couple of progressive artists who had a sort of industrial lot that they used for art, and the artists said, "We're renting out this lot. We have a couple year lease. You could come and park your buses on this lot, and the buses have the kitchen, all the kitchen stuff, and they set up their whole camp at this. And the next day, the very next evening, the police, 20 police in full riot gear, toting submachine guns, broke into the place and demanded to be able to search it.
Search it, being to search the buses?
Search the buses and search the whole place.
Without any warrant or anything?
They had no warrant, no.
They might find a French fry.
It was a pretty intimidating scene. The owner, the tenant, the artist was there. He at first argued with them, but after about an hour, he gave in and said, okay, you could search it. They found nothing. No drugs, no nothing of any evidence of any criminal activity. They found a lot of old bricks the artists used for their sculptures.
Right, installations and stuff.
So the police left, And more police came on the scene, and this was late at night this all happened, and a couple of the kids were walking back to one of the houses in the neighborhood that they were staying at. They weren't staying actually on the bus. They only had a couple of people for security on the bus. And the police stopped them, detained them. They detained them for an hour as loiterers, searched them in a very intimidating situation, and then eventually let them go. So this is one day and then the next day, and then they sent a building inspector out, who threatened the owner with a $1,000 a day fine unless he got rid of these people. And the owner essentially forced the artist to remove these people from the property. So they had to go somewhere else. They found another place then. These are just people who are coming to give out free food. This is their only offense, to give out free food. And this was the repression and the harassment that's taking place against them. Now, this I personally witnessed, because they then went and they found a place within the black community that was an abandoned school where the owner said, you can stay here. They had a whole caravan. As soon as they got to the place, within 2 minutes, before the bus could pull in to the lot, a police van swiftly moved in, blocked their entrance, the cops jumped out, and within 2 to 5 minutes, about 20 police cars with sirens screeching, lights flashing, and police dogs barking, jammed up the whole block, blocking entrance and access to the block. They spent 2 hours investigating the people and the bus, and searching the bus, and they finally gave them a citation for putting one wheel when they stopped. They moved up on the curb. So that was the only, they cited them for putting the bus on the curb.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe the story.
And for, these people have driven all around the country, but apparently they claimed that this was a commercial vehicle because it was an old bus, even though it doesn't carry any,
right.
Has only seats for 3 or 4 people. It has a kitchen, that's basically what it is. They gave them a citation for not having an author. They said you have to have a special kind of license to drive this vehicle. And they wouldn't even let them move the bus onto the lot, which was about 20 yards away, without getting an official bus driver to move the bus, which they eventually did. After 2 hours, the police left, but 2 o'clock in the morning, the owner of that lot came back with 3 or 4 policemen, saying he's been getting calls from the neighborhoods. You know, this is in a black community where they had this huge, major police incident, you know, just a few hours before, and the people were very upset. And they said, the owner said, I can't have you here on this property if you're going to, you know, if the police are going to be around, the media is going to be around, my neighbors are all going to be upset. I just can't do it. So you're going to have to move from this property. So they had already moved 3 times. And he gave them till 12 o'clock. With the policemen to move. Yesterday, as our court proceedings went on, they moved to a church on the north side, and the police followed them there, and apparently tried to get the pastor to evict them, but he wouldn't do it.
Oh my! This is our free America, right? Our protest. Oh
my gosh!
You know,
here are people, peaceful people. They're not even protesting.
Right.
All they're doing is providing free food to the protesters. They're a collective of young kids from Montana. They come into the city. This is their welcome. We brought a lawsuit charging a pattern and practice of harassment. And if there ever was a systematic pattern of harassment, this was it.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about 12 inches from the curb, having a tire on the curb, telling everybody not to have them in their parking lots or whatever.
So are you waiting for a decision?
No, we got a decision right away. And the judge said, given that the G20 is coming to town, there's huge security needs, our only remedy is damages. That we could sue for damages later, but essentially gave the city free rein to do whatever.
So the city can keep harassing and driving these people away, and all you can do is wait and months and months down the line attempt a lawsuit for damages.
Exactly. That's what's become of the First Amendment.
Yeah, I was going to say, the First Amendment, normally it's like an injunction is almost never given against First Amendment activities, and this is essentially saying the cops can harass you so much, deny your First Amendment rights, and then you can't stop them from doing that.
He explicitly said, I'm not going to determine, the judge in his decision said, I'm not going to determine whether there are any constitutional violations. Because even if there are constitutional violations, your only remedy is damages.
And it's ridiculous.
That's just not the law. I mean,
no, the law is First Amendment rights are precious. You exercise them at the time when they're necessary.
Right. And if you just have an isolated incident, then the court's going to say, well, you have to show that this is going to happen to you again. But this is day after day after day, the same thing is happening to these people.
So, Jules, are you going to appeal, or is there anything left really on that issue?
Well, it's apparently right now these folks are situated in this Northside church, and they're okay.
Jules.
But it makes you wonder if this is the way they treat peaceful protesters, what they're going to do for people who don't have a permit. I mean, these are people who went to the city, got a permit. They basically shut down this environmental group sustainability fair because they don't have the infrastructure. And by the way, this is just the most outrageous example of what's happening. But there were a couple of other buses also providing either food or some other infrastructure for this environmental group. And all of them have had the same police problems.
Jules, you think this is bad actions on the part of the Pittsburgh cops, or do you think they're working in conjunction with the federal police? What's your sense of it?
Well, I'm sure they're working in conjunction with the federal police. We've only been dealing, in this situation, it's only been the Pittsburgh police. What happens in these situations, and I think Bill Quigley wrote a very good article on Alternet on this, is that the federal authorities stay in the background, and they sort of manipulating the situation from afar. In fact, you know, when we went to court and when we negotiated, the federal authorities said, we have a very narrow security perimeter, and anything else is the city. But then when we tried to negotiate with the city for a march route, it would always seem like they'd have to go ask somebody else to get authorization and could never figure out who exactly you had to deal with. And that's, I think, one of the problems with this, that the federal authorities sort of stay in the background, let the city be up front.
Well, Jules, it's been a heroic and sometimes winning and sometimes losing struggle. But in the next couple of days, do you expect to be called on again?
If the last few days is any indication, I definitely expect to be called on again. I think that now a real environment of repression in Pittsburgh.
We've been talking with Professor Jules Lobel, who's also the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's fighting the good fight out there in Pittsburgh against the forces of darkness. Jules, thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Okay, thanks for inviting me.
Jules, thank you. I'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Amazing.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Domestic workers in New York State are pushing for the passage of their own Bill of Rights-style protections. The growing movement is made up mostly of women from countries such as the Philippines, Barbados, Trinidad, Jamaica, and Nepal. Some have stories of severe abuse. Others have been let go of jobs without notice or proper compensation. The ranks of domestic worker activists are filled with globalization's refugees, writes Lizzie Ratner in a recent article in The Nation magazine. In this segment, we explore the situation of domestic workers in New York State and throughout the country. We are joined today by Lizzie Ratner, as well as Linda Abad, a domestic worker and organizer for the Damayan Migrant Workers Association, part of a broader umbrella group in New York State, Domestic Workers United. Linda Abad and Lizzie Ratner, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Law and Disorder, for having us.
It's a pleasure to have you here, Linda. We wanted to ask you both about your work. Lizzie, as a journalist, had a major article in The Nation, the Organization of Domestic Workers. And Linda, you're one of the leaders in the whole campaign here. So Linda, can we first start out and talk with you and ask you, what kind of organizing are you doing now? What are you trying to accomplish?
Yeah, I'm an organizer with the Mayan Migrant Workers Association. We're a member of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, and we work very closely with Domestic Workers United in campaigning for the passage of the New York Bill of Rights.
And what is the New York Bill of Rights?
Well, this is a very ambitious bill. We hope to achieve fair labor standards, recognition, and win respect and dignity for the workforce through the Bill of Rights.
And who would be envisioned to be covered by this Bill of Rights? What kind of workers here in New York, and what are you trying to get for them?
So this bill promises to flip the conditions of domestic workers, meaning to say women and, you know, a few men, very few men who work in the homes of mostly American families.
So we're talking about caregivers to the elderly, nannies, people who do cleaning in homes, people like that, right?
Right.
And how many of those people are there in New York City?
There are 200,000 domestic workers in the city, and about 15% of them are Filipino domestic workers like me.
And your organization, Damayan, is made up primarily of Filipino workers?
Yes.
In New York City right now, is that what the main area for your for Damayan?
Yes, we're primarily in New York City, mostly in Queens, but we also have members from New Jersey, it's particularly Jersey City.
Now, were you once a domestic worker, or you still are yourself?
I've been a domestic worker since I came to the U.S. in 1996, and until now, I'm still doing that. I'm a part-time housekeeper for a couple in the West Side.
Now, in Lizzie Ratner's article, I think she talked about how you came from the Philippines and why you came, and sort of relating it to broader issues of globalization. Could you just talk about that for a minute?
Yes. I was a government employee in the Philippines. I had a home. Yeah, I had a family. I have two children. My story is that, like, you know, other Filipino women, our income in the Philippines as employees or as workers are just not enough to meet the needs of our family. And if we dream of, you know, giving quality education, university education to our children, you cannot just find the resources in the country. So I decided to try my luck in the U.S. I was already told how, you know, the domestic work is in the U.S., but it didn't really prepare me for the, you know, the discrimination, alienation in the job.
Yeah, well, I read about your bad luck working for that really awful family, first job you got there. Tell us in a nutshell what happened when you started working here.
Well, I worked in Livingston for a couple with three children. They had a very big house. So I would start at 7 o'clock in the morning and finish at about 9 or 10 in the evening. Yes, so I do everything, taking care of the three children, making meals for the children, cleaning the big home. That's really a huge home. And organizing, because they just moved in and the house is really upside down. So there's a lot of organizing in the home. I was only getting $225 dollars a week. It was really long hours, so much work, and I only worked there for 6 weeks. The lady was asking me if one of her friends, you know, talked me into moving to them, and I said no. But I really found a better job. A better job for me then was, you know, a job which was higher by $25 a week. It was not a lot of money, but for me it was a lot because I was supporting my children in college. When you're working in the privacy of homes and you do not have a network like an organization or friends who do who understand about the work, you just like you just swim alone in the ocean. You don't know the standards and the rules of the game. So, you know, in my next jobs, I got injured. I hurt because she was very clean, like obsessive compulsive.
Oh, what a nightmare.
I hurt myself, and when her children noticed that and told her, she wanted me to be seen by a local orthopedic in her area that was in Red Banks. But when I asked if she was going to pay the bill, she said, no, but you don't have to pay right away. So I told her, no, I would rather just wait, you know, because my services in my place are more affordable. So she never really helped me with that injury. And I didn't know if that was really, you know, the standard in the industry. So that's when I asked around, and with some Filipinos, we founded Damayan in about 2000.
So that was really the beginning of your organizing for domestic workers. Is that right, when you began that?
Yes, that's the beginning. I heard about, you know, the abuses, but it's different when you experience them personally. Yeah, I would consider myself to be quite assertive. I'm a thinking person. I just don't say yes to anyone. But when you're alone and the place is new and the culture is new, you just don't know what to do. So it's either you stick it out, you know, with bad conditions, or you get out. Like you resign if you can. But nowadays it's very hard to do that.
Let me ask you about the legislation that's going through New York, Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. That's passed, I think, the Assembly now and not the Senate yet. And I'm interested in comparing what particularly your early jobs were as against what the rights are now if the bill passes. One is, it says that you're supposed to get overtime pay in the legislation. Did you get overtime pay when you were working?
No, I never had that. So when a worker is not aware of the standard, like, you know, under the law, there's a law now that, you know, when you work leave-in, after 4 to 4 hours, you should get time and a half of the minimum wage, right, under the New York State law. So if you're not aware of that, you won't complain, you won't assert. So that's prevailing in the industry. Women who work in the home, like housekeepers and babysitters, even if they work leave out, they don't know that they are entitled to that benefit, that they can claim overtime. So in my experience, I never got that. I work an average of 11 to 12 hours a day, like 55 to 60 hours a week, and I never got overtime.
The legislation also talks about sick days, vacation, holidays, paid time off. Did you get any of that?
Sick days, that's not known in the industry. It's discretionary on the part of the employer. So oftentimes it's a struggle to take a day off, you know, for you to see a doctor when you're sick. Because the employer would rather have you stay in the home, you know, take something, you know, aspirin or Tylenol. And if you're really sick, then she'll let you go. But it's a question whether she'll pay you for that day or not. So it's always discretionary, and the worker is always on the receiving end, and it's not just good.
One of the most, interesting parts of the bill for me is the health care issue. And it says employers must provide domestic worker employees with either health benefits equivalent to those provided by the Healthy New York plan, or an amount no less than the lowest cost of a Healthy New York plan. I assume that the work you've done as a domestic worker and your friends or the other people in Damayan or in Domestic Workers United don't generally get health care from their employers. Is that right?
That's true. 9 out of 10 domestic workers do not get health insurance. It's very rare that you find employers who are willing to give you health insurance. So it's a great need. And unfortunately, we're still not covered. The Assembly bill, called Inclusion Bill, even the Senate version of our bill, does not provide for health insurance.
So even if we get this new legislation through, or if really you get this new legislation through, there still won't be a requirement of health insurance. Is that right?
What they're offering to us right now does not include health insurance. Our original bill includes that because per our survey and our, you know, knowledge on the job, domestic workers are very much exposed to health hazards like sick children or sick elderly and hazardous cleaning chemicals in the home. So we really need that. But I don't know. We saw the inclusion bill from the assembly. It does not include health coverage. And what the Senate is intending to talk about and pass for us does not also include health coverage.
Linda, what about workers' compensation if you get hurt on the job, or Social Security for your old age, or unemployment insurance if you get laid off? Are you making any progress in trying to secure those benefits for your coworkers?
I think if the worker is documented and she's paying taxes and the employer is paying taxes also, she would be covered by Social Security. But many of the workers in the industry work off the books, and so that's a big question. So they don't have safety nets. So when they're injured on the job, it's a struggle. Like, you have to really, you know, sue your employer if negotiations fail. If not, they won't really help you. I know of a worker who was bitten by the dog, and the employer is a doctor. She had to fight so that, you know, she will be given compensation, and she was only given $1,000 for that.
Let me ask about some other laws. OSHA, which is the safety law of the federal law, does that apply to domestic workers?
Occupational Safety.
Yes.
And Health Act. Right now, we're excluded from that. The inclusion bill promises to include us in some state-level civil rights, right? But I don't think we're included there. So as I said, there's no provision for us for health.
That would have to happen on a federal level because OSHA is a federal law. The NLRB, the Labor Relations Act, is a federal law. So even if the state law passes, you won't be protected, still won't be protected by NLRB or OSHA, I guess.
I guess, but in the inclusion bill, they said we can have now the collective bargaining rights because we will be included in the state level.
Right, that would be quite important. Let me ask you a last question and then turn to Lizzie. So you were one of the founders of DEMAIN, which is the Filipino workers group, and that then became, as you started the interview, as it became one of the coalition groups of Domestic Workers United?
Domestic Workers United is a very large and strong organization of Caribbean and Latina domestic workers. It's one of the big organizations of domestic workers in New York and a leading member of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. So it's an organization, and apart from that, we have an alliance. DEMAIN is also a member of the alliance.
And you have some recent activities coming up. I think when you came in, you gave us a flyer on one of them, a name I can't really pronounce, so I won't try. But what does it say? What does the flyer say?
Yes, on October 3, DEMAIN is organizing a workers' workshop on unemployment benefits and combating wage theft. Yeah, because nowadays, so many workers are getting deeper into trouble, you know, with their employers, because many are laid off without notice. Hours are, you know, lessened. Pay are, you know, lessened. These are abrupt and unilateral on the part of the employer. There's no discussion. And so the workers need more information and training on how to sort out these things so that they can negotiate and assert their rights with their employers.
And what does it say across the top of the leaflet? What's the word?
The word on top of this is ipaglaban, which means fight. Fight or struggle. Yes. So that activity is on October 3. Thank you so much. We're inviting domestic workers, especially Filipino domestic workers. It will be in Queens, Woodside. We're inviting NELP. And lawyers.
NELP is what?
National Employment Law Project, and also the Urban Justice Center.
What time and what exact address, Linda?
The date is October 3 from 1 o'clock to 4 p.m., and it will be held in Woodside, 53-22 Roosevelt Avenue.
Can we draw Lizzie Ratner, journalist, into the conversation with you, Linda?
Yes, please.
Lizzie, Michael and I were really interested in reading your article in The Nation, and you make the point that the kind of work that Linda's doing is really combining feminism and labor organizing and international immigrants' right work, all three at the same time. It's really quite a phenomena. Tell me what got you interested in covering this for the magazine.
Yes, I will gladly tell you. But first, I have to say that so much of the analysis, to the extent that I have analysis in this article, it really comes from talking to women like Linda, and in particular to talking to Linda, whose analysis has always been so smart and probing on this issue. And she really forced me to keep thinking in our conversations about how this particular movement draws in strands from many other movements, and how, while it is incredibly valuable to focus on efforts like the Bill of Rights, none of the real problems of domestic workers will be fundamentally solved until you take on some of the greater issues like the treatment of women, the treatment of immigrants in this country, the treatment of people of color. So I just have to thank Linda for that, for always stressing that to me and helping me understand this movement. So back to your original question, what got me interested, about a year and a half ago, a friend of mine mentioned this happening, this phenomenon in New York State, which was a movement of domestic workers to get a Bill of Rights passed, which Linda just described. And so I was lucky enough to be able to accompany a large group of domestic workers and allies to Albany in the spring of 2008, and I accompanied them as a journalist. And I didn't know too much about the movement at the time, but what I saw inspired me, and also much of what I learned horrified me and opened my eyes and my mind. And so a quick description of what I saw. It was the spring of 2008. The struggle for the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights was, I think, in its fourth year at the time, because it began in late 2003. And about 200 people went up to Albany, and it was domestic workers, it was nannies, it was elder caregivers, it was housekeepers, and it was a lot of allies. It was members of the labor movement, so SEIU, UFCW, it was grassroots groups, it was actually civil rights groups, members of the Center for Constitutional Rights came up to support the lobby day. Among the many things that stood out for me and sort of impressed me was there were about 200 people, as I said, and you had these people came from all over in terms of their political affiliations, but also in terms of the domestic workers. You had women from Haiti, you had women from the Philippines, you had women from Mexico, you had women from El Salvador, you had women from the Caribbean. You had this incredibly multi-ethnic, polyglot group of women coming together, and they were leading the day completely. I was lucky enough to accompany a number of groups into meetings with legislators, and it was always a domestic worker, a woman, almost always a woman, who'd been working in somebody's home, who had taken the day off at great risk to herself because, as Linda explained, domestic workers don't have the right to a day off, certainly not to a paid day off. So these women had come out at great risk to themselves, and they were going in front of legislators and saying, "Here's how we're treated in people's homes. We make all work possible in this state. We make so much work possible, certainly in New York City, and yet we don't have rights." And at the time, the bill had only had a sponsor in the state assembly. It didn't have a Senate sponsor yet. And what's more, it hadn't even gotten out of the labor committee at the time. And yet, the sense of sort of rebellious, exuberant defiance that was exhibited that day, there was, you know, people could have said, "We've been fighting for this for a long time, and it's ridiculous that in this country we don't have these rights, and we still have to fight to even get out of committee." And there was frustration and anger, but there was mostly just a determination of, okay, we'll be back next week then, and we'll be back the week after that, and the week after that. And so I guess kind of finally, in witnessing this in action, I saw what was to me one of the most exciting and thrilling examples of a movement that I've seen in a long time, one that was led by women, was led almost entirely by women of color, by women who were immigrants, documented and undocumented, and women who were who'd been traditionally excluded by the labor movement and certainly by labor law, and were saying, okay, we're taking a stand as workers.
We're speaking to Lizzie Ratner, wrote an article in The Nation called The New Domestic Order, and Linda Abad, who's from Damayan Migrant Workers Association, about really the situation for domestic workers in the United States. So, Lizzie, give us some sense of the national scope of what's really happening here.
Sure, and then I'm also going to ask Linda to come in, because Linda's been working with a lot of people on the national stage. But my understanding from talking to Linda and talking to other members of the movement is that over the last decade or 15 years or so, you've seen, again, women mostly, domestic workers coming together in cities and localities throughout the country, in California, in Texas, in Seattle, in Miami, in New York, of course, many of whom migrated to this country during the last few decades and who've come together and said, we're being treated terribly. In many cases, it began, my understanding is, as an attempt to sort of fight on an individual basis for women's rights, for domestic workers' rights, and then in the last few years has grown into a real sort of consciousness, again, sort of individually in these multiple areas, that if you really want to get rights for domestic workers, you have to begin to organize and you have to begin to change the laws and change the system. And so in California right now, a number of groups are coming together to begin working on their own legislation, their own Bill of Rights legislation. In Maryland, a couple of years ago, members of a group, Casa de Maryland, came together and were able to pass a local law in Montgomery County that requires employers to alert domestic workers to their rights and, I guess, sort of sign a contract and say, we agree to adhere to these rights. And I think if the New York law gets passed, more importantly, when it gets passed, hopefully very soon, it will be a message to legislators throughout the country, as well as to other groups who are beginning to organize, that will say, this can be done, this should be done, this has to be done. So, but I'm going to turn it over to Linda now, because you've been working with the women of the National Alliance.
Yes. There is now, we are very, very proud of our National Alliance. In June of 2007, during the U.S. Social Forum, I was very lucky to represent Damayan in the meeting of several domestic workers' organizations nationally to found the National Domestic Workers Alliance. So it was in Atlanta, Georgia, where the alliance was founded. 2 years after that, the alliance was able to do its very first Congress here in New York City. And it has created a national coordinating committee leading the organizing work and supporting the campaigns and other programs to build the national domestic workers movement.
I have a question about historically that Lizzie mentions in her article, and particularly during the Roosevelt administration, when domestic workers as well as agricultural workers were kept out of the legislation. Either of you can answer this. Lizzie basically says in the article, as a compromise with the South, with the Southern states, because they didn't want their domestic workers, who were mostly black then, as well as their agriculture workers, who likewise were mostly black, to be protected by any of these laws, from the labor relations law to the safety laws. Is that how you understand it, Linda?
That's how I came from the Philippines, right? But in our education work among, sister organizations, we have understood the history of slavery in the U.S. So what happened in 1935 with the New Deal was really when they excluded domestic workers and farm workers from these major federal labor laws was clearly racism, right? They excluded their slaves, black Americans mostly, who were doing the housework and working in the farms from these protections.
By taking away legal status to them, essentially, really was a continuation of what had happened prior.
Yes, and that happened in 1935, and it still exists to the present, and that's the stage when other women from poor countries came to the U.S., beginning 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, to fill in the vacancies left by black American domestic workers who were given opportunities to work in other areas after the civil rights movement.
What seems so extraordinary to me is that in these times when the major industrial unions like auto and steel and rubber are really taking it on the chin, the most downtrodden of all workers in this country are getting it together and organizing. And I think just that inspiration alone could serve to nudge others in the right direction.
I think it's a natural reaction or natural course of history that when people are being abused, it will be a natural reaction to get together and just think how you can protect yourself.
You know, for me sitting here, that's actually really critical. I mean, not just the point about women's work, which I think has been recognized for a long time as supposedly non-work, whether done by wives or domestic workers or spouses, but visibility, because I think making yourselves visible really will send a message to people that we're human, we're doing real work. Where can people go to find out more? We know they can go to Domestic Workers United website. They can go to your website. And where can they go to find out more about the legislation? What's the best place for them to go?
Well, right now we're planning a trip, another trip to Albany on September 29. So if people are available, please come with us. We need to put pressure on the Senate so that they will include the agenda, this agenda, to their session on September 29.
And how do they do that?
Just like before, I'm sure that there will be a bus in Union Square going to Albany. Just like before, it will be at 6 a.m., you know, near Barnes & Noble. Mm-hmm. In Union Square.
And is there a way they can go, a website they can go to make to find out about it? What if there's too many people for the bus?
The organizer of this trip would be Domestic Workers United, so they can always call DWU or go to their website. And you can also call us if you want, Damayan.
People can go to our website. They can find out how to get on the bus. We really want to thank you both. I mean, this was extraordinary, and it's just a part of New York and the country that people just don't take into consideration enough, and that you're there now is terrific, Linda. And Lizzie, thank you for covering this for a number of years now, but we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.